Hello, and welcome to another episode of Decisions That Matter, a public procurement podcast brought to you by Procurated. This week, Procurated CEO David Yarkin is joined by Jenny Doherty and Sharon Minich from Pennsylvania's State System of Higher Education, also known as PASHE. Jenny and Sharon are in the midst of an incredible transformation journey, reimagining Pennsylvania's decentralized higher ed procurement administration to create a commodity-based central organization serving all 14 universities. With Sharon driving strategy and Jenny leading execution, during this episode, we hear the full story of this incredible journey from ideation to launch. The story truly is a great one, and we hope you enjoy and learn a lot from this episode.
Welcome to the Decisions That Matter podcast, where we meet with leaders from across the procurement community to discuss innovative and strategic ideas. Because when it comes to procurement, every decision matters.
Well, welcome everybody. I'm here with two great procurement and administrative leaders from Pennsylvania, Sharon Minich and Jenny Doherty. We're going to talk about how they have led this incredible transformation of procurement within higher education in Pennsylvania. And I'm really excited to help them tell their story or listen to them tell their story. Before we get started with some quick introductions, Sharon, you want to tell us a little bit about your background and what brought you to PASHE and what you've been doing there?
My background is a blend of public sector and private sector experience. But in both leading large-scale transformation initiatives, so worked about 50% of my time in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania doing a variety of projects for the Budget Office, the Department of General Services and Procurement, Department of Revenue, and then at the end serving as a secretary in the Office of Administration for Governor Wolf, overseeing HR and IT. What brought me to PASHE was the system redesign and the chancellor and the vision he had to transform PASHE so that it is a more vibrant system for the future students in the state. And being part of that transformation and bringing that skill set was really why I joined.
And what was the timing of that, Sharon?
That was January of 2019, 2 years ago.
Very good. All right. And Jenny?
Yeah, so I joined PASHE not quite a year ago, June 1st, so I'm almost at the 1 year mark. And my background is in both private and public sector procurement. I spent about 20 years doing private sector procurement. And then I spent 3 years as the chief procurement officer for the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania when Sharon was at the Commonwealth. And so this was also under Governor Wolf. And then spent the last 2 years at Amazon Business helping other states to implement procurement best practices and modern procurement practices through Amazon Business. And then I came to PASHE really because of Sharon. So this gave me an opportunity to do something I've never done, which is around this whole transformational initiative and really looking at procurement from an organizational perspective and building a procurement shared services organization and not just doing like soup to nuts procurement. So it's been a fast, furious, and exciting past 11 months.
Incredible. And so one thing that I know about both of you, which you both talked about, is that neither one of you, from my experience, ever wanted to be a sort of a procurement caretaker, keeping the seat warm, right? It's always been about transformation and change.
Yeah.
And it sounds like you had an opportunity here to do it. So let's talk about PASHE, maybe as a quick background for people outside of the state. What is PASHE? You know, how many schools? How is it organized?
I can take that one. PASHE is State System of Higher Education here in Pennsylvania. It's 14 universities. Organized through a system office with the Office of the Chancellor. The universities are all run by their own president. And so it's a governance model where the presidents manage the universities. It has a board that manages the ENG or the academic side of the organization. And each of the universities have trustees. and they're overseeing the auxiliary sides of the universities. And so it's a very blended governance model. It's about a $2 billion budget, about 95,000 students that we serve on an annual basis. And so it's a state-run university system here in Pennsylvania.
And in terms of the autonomy that the individual campuses have had when it comes to, I think you call them auxiliary functions like procurement, historically, what does that look like? How much sort of central involvement has there been in the operations versus autonomy at the local level?
Historically, the universities have primarily been very independent across not just procurement, but all threads. So there's a very limited shared service function for benefits, for the common ERP system, for internet networking. But in terms of procurement, it was very limited in terms of shared services. Most of that was decentralized to the universities, and they had their own procurement organizations similar to HR and IT and very decentralized functions.
Yeah, and just to add to that, out of the system office, there's a very small, you know, fewer than five people team that would put into place system-wide contracts for things like office supplies and IT hardware and MRO, but those contracts are optional. They're there if the universities want to use them, but they are not mandatory. So in many cases, the universities were still doing their own contracts if they wanted to.
If you had to put a percentage on it, Jenny, you know, how much compliance were you getting with those for system-wide contracts?
I would say maybe 20%. Mm-hmm. It's really more about convenience. If there's something there that they want, then great.
And what did the procurement offices look like? How many folks worked in the procurement offices on campus? What was the level of experience of the purchasing directors?
I will say it ranged in terms of both the numbers and the experience levels, because we have probably like many systems across the country, we've got schools of varying sizes. We have universities that serve 1,300 students, and we have universities that serve almost 10,000 plus students. So based on that range, obviously the employee size of procurement shops ranged as well. They were probably anywhere between 3 to 7 in terms of their purchasing staff. And then they also had some construction functions that sometimes were in procurement and sometimes were not. Those were also kind of non-standard across the university system. And then, as with any skill set, you're going to see rangings in skill sets based on, the size and the scope of the university activities.
How tenured were they? Are they people who've been in those jobs a long time? Are they more mid-career?
And Jenny probably has more of that than I do off the top of my head. I think we're a blend of management and AFSCME as part of our procurement organization. So we had many that were long tenured employees. And then we had probably some that were mid-career. We didn't have a lot of new individuals. There were a few, but I wouldn't say, the majority was probably made up with long-term system or university employees as well as kind of midterm.
And do you think that the procurement directors on the campuses and their staff, do they view themselves as members of sort of a collective, members of PASHI procurement, or do they see themselves as really responding to the needs on campus?
I would say the latter for sure. And I think what we're seeing now as we're bringing everyone together is there's almost relief that there's this larger collective team of procurement professionals to rely on and to kind of bounce ideas and collaborate with. Because before at the university, everyone was just trying to figure it out. I think there was a lot of just sort of general problem solving, and many things that were not really procurement would get handed over to procurement to do. So there was sort of a philosophy that contract equals procurement,
And in many cases, payment equals procurement, which is not the case. So we're trying to unravel a lot of that. So these are things we're seeing now as we bring people together. Well, we use our P card for that. Well, we use a purchase rec for that, the same thing. So I would say they have not traditionally seen themselves as part of a larger collection of procurement professionals.
And I think that was a bit of the transformation because, you know, there is something as part of a university where you're on campus, you're with the students, you have the mascot, you have the football teams, you have all of that, you know, you come into a shared service procurement organization. We don't have a physical location, we don't have a mascot, we don't have those things that give a culture and a feel for your organization. So they felt very tied to the organization and the university culture, much more so than the system office, which really doesn't have that kind of culture. It's a very small group of people, you know, that serve the universities. So I think probably Jenny can talk more about it. That was a big transformation to go from I'm serving one to I'm serving many.
Yeah. And I want to talk in a little bit about how you pulled off the transformation and what did that look like and what did it feel like, but just for a little more background, what do you think the attitude of folks on campus was towards, you know, people in corporate in the PASCHE central office historically?
You know, I think historically there was a lot of trust that needed to be rebuilt when the new chancellor came in. And only being here 2 years, I can't explain, you know, the reasoning behind that. But I do think it was more of an environment where it was a top-down approach rather than a collaborative approach. And by collaboration, I mean collaboration amongst the presidents and the varying groups underneath the presidents, the CAOs, the CFOs, the other direct reports to the president. And so previously it was kind of the chancellor's office and then the presidents. There's a separation. I think, you know, the chancellor did a lot of work to bring that together. So it was probably less collaborative historically between the two.
All right. So you came into this role, Sharon, a year or so before Jenny. It sounds like you came in to do big things, largely around, you know, applying the same things you had done with the Commonwealth to the system. What was the big impetus behind, you know, creating a shared services organization?
It started with system redesign, and that started at late 2018. Really, the board kicked it off in 2019 in terms of what we are doing right now. And system redesign had a couple threads in it. And it was really driven by student success, university success, to get the universities to a more financially stable model for the future, because we had been historically losing enrollments. The demographics have been shifting. Enrollments have been declining because of the lower high school graduating population, and two, our increasing costs as we were raising tuition and room and board. You started to see this gap in terms of students coming into the system schools. And so system redesign was really to kind of look holistically around what we could do to redesign the system to better function for the students now and in the future. And so a large piece of that was, what can we do to share? So we had some sharing, like I talked about. We had, you know, limited in certain areas, and there was an analysis of where we could leverage the universities into a more shared service model. And procurement and HR were two that were brought out as part of that analysis. And procurement had a couple of threads. One was shared services, the other was strategic sourcing, and the third was automation. So there was like three areas within procurement that were ripe to help the universities. So it was part of a bigger picture for the system in terms of transformation. It was kind of one thread of it to kind of start the journey.
And how did you sequence procurement and HR? Did you see them as sort of related in the way you rolled them out? Were they totally on separate tracks?
Everything was kind of brought as a package to the board in October of 2019. And then we were working on the models, working on the processes when COVID hit in March of 2020. And when that happened, I think that there was a much bigger focus at that point from the presidents on, we've got to move, and we've got to move faster than we were intending to move, because they were seeing that, you know, they needed to make changes in their schools as they were basically shifting to no students on campus and remote learning and not sure when they were going to come back. So how do they also drive down their costs and still do their service provision? And so after COVID, well, during COVID really, but after that spring semester of 2020, in probably June, July, a couple different opportunities, HR, procurement, were brought forward to the presidents, and they said move forward with both of them, different timelines. Procurement had a much quicker implementation path because Bloomsburg University had already started proving the model. So they had started to do shared services for some of their sister schools in the system. And so it was already kind of a foot in the door. And they said, okay, let's bring in the rest. And that's really where it started after the spring semester of 2020. Jenny joined in June, and it kind of kicked off in July.
How important was Jenny's role to this success?
She was extremely important because we needed, we really needed to bring somebody in who could lead the vision forward, who understood procurement services, how to create that professional procurement organization, what they should be doing, and to kind of lead that transformation. So she was critical to making this, all three initiatives, successful. Without her, I think it would have been a much, much more difficult journey to go on. She was absolutely essential for the role and, you know, really brought in to do that work.
Still underway, so still a lot to do.
Jenny, as you, one thing that's interesting I was going to say to Sharon is I've seen a lot of universities, you know, hire new CPOs, and I've seen some really talented and qualified people without higher ed procurement experience just get cut from consideration because they didn't have that higher ed experience. Tell me a little bit, Sharon and Jenny, from both your perspectives, why, because I think this is your first time in higher ed, why, you know, so that was something you could trade off in return for other experiences. I guess it's more for Sharon first, but maybe Jenny, your reaction afterwards about coming in without that higher ed experience and whether that was curse, a blessing, a little bit of both.
It's interesting. I think it's probably a little bit of both, because in any place that you go in where you don't have the industry knowledge, you've got to get it quickly so that you're speaking their language. But at the same time, you know, you're brought in for different things. So, you know, the experience that I brought was what they were looking for, and just trying to understand the culture in higher ed is a very different thing. You know, every organization has a different culture. And so it's, what is the culture here? How does it work? Certainly knowing your limits. You know, I am not on the academic side. I'm not going to be talking about, you know, curriculum and those kinds of things. But, you know, I think there is also a bit of, and it's not just higher ed, but in any organization where you come in and you don't have that background, it's a bit of a proving. You've got to prove yourself to them that you know what you're talking about and you can apply it in their environment.
And maybe to follow up on that for both of you, maybe to Jenny in particular, how would you compare higher ed procurement to state procurement? How similar are they? What are the big areas of differences?
So I think there are a lot of similarities in that, you know, we're still bound by the procurement code, there are procurement policies and statutes. And so you still have all of that, but it seems if I had to sort of diagnose this at a high level, it seems like it's less mature. So, you know, in state government and coming from the Commonwealth, it's like it was a fairly well-oiled machine of, you know, procurement, shared services, a centralized procurement shop. The agencies knew what that relationship was and that dynamic, and they respect it, and it's built. Whereas here in higher ed, and I think, while this is my only higher ed experience so far, but what I've heard from colleagues is that it is a much more decentralized structure typically. And I think that almost makes it a less mature organization, because there's so many inefficiencies built into that decentralized organization, which can be challenging. And I think, you know, to get back to that earlier question, I think one of the things that sort of helped me is that I didn't have that higher ed background in a way, but yet I had the public procurement background. So I'm respectful of the policies and the procedures and the importance of working very closely with our legal counsel and business partners, but I wasn't, I guess, overly sensitive to the culture of higher ed because I didn't know it. So I think that is part of why Sharon and I were able to come in without a higher ed experience, because we had the public experience but weren't overly sensitive to the dynamics of a higher ed organization, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so there may be some ideas that if you had spent your career in higher ed, you never would have advanced, because you would say, oh, you just can't do that in higher ed. No, that didn't happen because you didn't have any sort of breaks on your creativity and your imagination. That.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that when I say it's less mature, I don't mean that in a bad way. It's just, it creates opportunity, because coming from the Commonwealth, where it was a pretty mature organization, but we still made big changes, I knew the art of the possible and that it could be done. And that I had already learned in public procurement that just because somebody says you can't do something doesn't mean you really can't. Like, ask for the policy, look at it, challenge the status quo, and that there is often an audience that's very receptive to that and relieved almost by that. There's another audience that's can be intimidated by that, and you know, there's always fear of change, but we can work through that.
Yeah. Great. So that's all really helpful background. Let's jump into the change. So Sharon, you talked about this being sort of a three-headed monster, if you will, strategic sourcing, shared services, and automation. So tell me about how, you know, sort of you drew up the plans for all three of them and how you executed, you know, each of the three.
Well, I can turn the execution over to Jenny, because she did the execution. There is an individual that I think we also should mention, Jeff Mandel, who has worked at the Commonwealth and worked in the system office and at Bloomsburg University, who had a lot of these concepts in process for many years and had been trying to move them forward. And so when redesign came, we leveraged what he had done. And so when you look at those three threads, the plan for strategic sourcing, we had brought in a third party because we knew we didn't have the maturity or the bandwidth, honestly, to be able to do strategic sourcing while we were doing other things. And we also knew that the system, because we had such a decentralized procurement system, that the data in the system was really bad. And so just the time to do the analytics on the sourcing, we didn't have. And so we outsourced the sourcing component, and that kind of was a large work effort, but the burden of a lot of the analytics was off the team. So that was kind of one thread that we could continue to move forward with a great partner, but not have to have a large drain on our resources. On the procurement model, that actually started as a plan before Jenny joined. And it was both a VP and Jeff and some others had come together and then presented that plan to the presidents. And the plan was to create kind of a regional, two regions, East and West, that served groups of universities with the central group in the middle, you know, leveraging what the Bloomsburg University had started and to kind of roll it out, starting with the East because they had already moved forward and then, or, yes, and then pulling in the West. Jenny can talk during execution how that all changed, but that was the original plan. And then the third piece was Ariba. And, you know, as we looked at pulling this organization together, you know, it was trying to align the new technology with the organization. So how to not stand up a new organization using old practices and processes. And so blending what we were doing from an org design with the technology implementation to give them the tools they needed and to also give them the freedom to redesign the process to a better way so that they're moving forward with a more standardized process that is part of a system that's getting implemented versus everybody's use of the current system in their old way. And so we tried to align the technology to mirror the implementation of the organization. So when the organization came up, it had the tool designed associated with it. So that was kind of the overarching plan and vision. And then Jenny can certainly, Jenny had all of the execution, which was a lot.
Yeah, so, but I had a lot of help too. So, I mean, really it started once we had alignment on, okay, this is what we're going to do, now go do it. You know, all good things start with a really good spreadsheet, right? A really good project plan was created with lots of action items. We had HR helping, we had labor relations helping, we had IT helping, and then of course our procurement leads. And we took these two regional offices and basically broke things down into three phases. So Sharon mentioned Bloomsburg was already doing kind of this on a small scale with five schools. We did what we called a lift and shift with those five, moved them into shared services first, which means they become system office employees. How do we do that from an IT, HR, you know, labor relations? So we sort of practiced or piloted it on that group. Then we did another, that was October. And then in January, we brought on several more schools and started the West. And then in March, we brought on the last school. So one of the things that was really important to us was creating opportunity for leadership roles in the new organization. We didn't want to just assign people to spots. So we created an org, like a just a shell of an org chart. And we wanted to create a procurement structure that went from being university focused, which is still what they were doing in kind of this initial Bloomsburg launch, to a commodity-based procurement organization, which is really a best practice. So we created services teams, material teams, IT teams, and a construction team. And so we created lead positions. So the other thing that was challenging is all of the procurement leaders at the universities had to have a director title. They were procurement directors. Well, I'm a director. So we can't have, you know, all these directors in this new organization that didn't really make sense. So what do we call these people? What do we call these new leadership positions? So we came up with what I think is a more modern term of lead. So they're commodity leads. So we created job descriptions for all of these new leadership positions. Then we posted them and they were only available for the existing procurement leadership folks. And then we had them select their first, second, and third choice. And we interviewed everybody. And then we made selections. And then we did sort of slot the AFSCME employees across the various teams based on their positions and the expected volume within those teams. So then we kind of phase everybody in.
One good question, Jenny. Were there any campus purchasing directors who didn't get one of those leadership roles?
So there was a leadership role for all existing leaders.
And they were leading commodity teams.
They're now leading commodity teams.
Got it.
Yes. So we're still in that transition phase. So when they came in, it wasn't like on day one, they just drop everything that they've been working on for their home university and all suddenly start doing nothing but IT. So we're still in that transition phase in these early months. The other major kind of shift that happened at the same time, which the discussion started well before this, was aligning our legal partners to this new organization. So before, each of the universities had their own procurement team and each university has their own attorney. And so what we learned in the Bloomsburg early model was it's really difficult for a purchasing agent to have to work with five different attorneys. It's very difficult. And many times you're getting five different answers depending who you ask, which, you know, that's actually not a bad thing.
And that could work.
Right. That's not a bad thing, but it creates challenges. So starting the dialogue early with the legal team to say, here's our vision. Here's when we're thinking about shifting. We would love for you to align the way we're aligned. And that was a really foreign concept initially. And I think now we're there and we do have alignment. We have an attorney for the Western Region Procurement Office, an attorney for the Eastern. One of those is focused on IT across both teams. And then the third attorney, who's the lead, supports the strategic sourcing team and oversees the other two attorneys. And it's actually working out quite well for all of us. So those are sort of the major execution tasks. You know, there's lots of little things, like we had to meet with labor relations and AFSCME and, you know, lots of other details. But those were really the big things.
So there was a proposal to have an Eastern and a Western group. Is that still the case, or have you merged them into sort of one organization?
So that's still the case, although we're already starting to morph a little bit. I think the future is that we have one organization that's combined. We were originally expecting two IT leads, and Westchester didn't come. They were the only school who didn't come into the new structure. And their procurement director was the IT lead. And so now we have one IT team that kind of supports both RPS. So I think over time, you know, as people retire and things change, we will kind of align naturally to that structure.
So are you sourcing, say, MRO for the Eastern schools and sourcing MRO for the Western schools, or are you sharing contracts between the two halves of the state?
So things that are for all universities, like office supplies and MRO and IT hardware, those have been falling under this kind of third-party consulting support that we've gotten that Sharon mentioned, which falls really under the system office, our strategic sourcing team.
Yeah. And so they're in place. Are they in place for the foreseeable future to do sourcing of, you know, common goods and services?
Yes.
Got it. Great.
Well, it's two people and half of me.
And when you look at the spend in higher ed, it's quite different than the spend in public sector. Interestingly, you know, in the public sector, you have IT as one of your biggest spends, which is not, you know, dining is one of our biggest spends. And so, you know, our spend levels are less, and at least less in comparison to, you know, the state, when you compare a state level spend. And the types of spend, you get a few, and Jenny probably can rattle them off, but once you get past dining, MRO, office supplies, and some others, it really drops in terms of volume.
Yeah.
I mean, most things are $1 million or less. I mean, there's just a lot of little things.
Yeah. So those Eastern and Western groups are really focused on sort of one-off transactions more so than they are sort of system-wide requirements.
For the most part. So when we can collaborate across schools, that's the intention. So if somebody needs municipal waste services, well, let's just do one of those per region.
Right.
And everybody's needs.
Right.
Which is going to streamline things significantly for the suppliers as well. Wanting to 9 RFPs, you've got one.
Right. But my last sourcing question, and I want to talk about the technology and process work you've done that complements it. One of the things, so for listeners out there, way back when I used to work with the Commonwealth, and I remember meeting very clearly with all the universities, and we tried to do something similar. And they all came back and they said, well, David, you don't understand. Our job isn't necessarily to get the best price. We are pillars of our community. Our job is to, in many ways, be an economic development engine to help foster, you know, job creation in the part of the state where our campuses. Interested to get your take on that topic of sort of local, regional, small businesses and, you know, the importance they had in procurement sort of historically and how that has evolved, if it has, as you've gone to more of a central approach.
I can start and then Jenny can jump in. I think, you know, we have schools, many of our schools are in rural regions, and that's absolutely true that they are the economic engines in those regions. At the same time, they also see the cost, you know, any cost is borne by either an appropriation or a student through tuition. We've got two sources of revenue, tuition revenue and the appropriation. And so they have to, the universities are in a very delicate position of balancing their regional presence and also trying to drive down their costs so that, you know, students, so that we can keep tuition under control and keep it affordable for our students. And so it is a balancing act. And I don't know, you know, we've done those, kind of the high spend commodities. I think one of the biggest ones, and Jenny can talk about it, is we've got almost everyone into regional dining contracts, which is our large spend category, which really drove down costs, which then drives it right out to the student. But I think they're always going to be in that position because in many of these rural communities, they are, you know, one of the largest, if not the largest employer and an engine for economic development in their areas. And so we have to kind of manage that with what we do.
Yeah. And I think it is a balancing act. And we need to be very thoughtful about how we balance that. So I would really question paying more for a local supply, significantly more that we have on a system-wide contract that'll be delivered the next day versus, you know, a local service that you can only get locally. You know, that's really different than buying copy paper from a local provider. So, and I think when you look at the campuses and the students are supporting the local economies too, and in dining and, you know, the services that they need in their communities. So it's not just on procurement to support those local vendors. It's much bigger than that. And so I think it is a balancing act, balancing the local with the financial stability of the universities and the end goal of providing education for the students at an affordable cost.
I wonder whether if I'm on the Indiana University of Pennsylvania campus historically, and I'm doing a procurement, whether by sort of physically being there, it makes me, you know, creates a sense of pressure around the local economy that I may not have if I'm at California or Slippery Rock or somewhere that's not quite as close, and whether that gives them, you know, almost a little bit more impartiality or freedom to do what's in the system's interest.
Yeah, and I think it's really around, you know, that those two words that are so important in procurement, best value, you know, so what's providing the best value outcome and really juggling that. Like, if you think about your personal lives, you know, I'll pay a little bit more to have organic,
But if I'm spending someone else's money, am I able to do that? Is that appropriate? You know, what creates the definition around best value when you're spending other people's money?
Right. So interesting. Let's turn to the third pillar that Sharon talked about around sort of standardizing processes, putting in a common technology platform. Talk to me a little bit about sort of what was the, you know, the impetus for that, the timing, the sequencing, the execution.
So I can do the impetus because it started before Jenny got here, and then she can talk about how she really kind of joined, I think, the week before kickoff. So she knew it was going to be on the agenda. We have an SAP system that was implemented back, I want to say in probably 2005-ish. So it's quite, it's been up to date, but it's still a bit antiquated. And so it didn't have a lot of the modern tools that a lot of the e-procurement systems had. And so we were really looking for a way to automate, not just procure, but procure to pay. Because all of the invoices were still coming in paper and going to accounts payable and doing the data entry. And so we were really looking at a tool that would be able to give us kind of a twofold benefit in terms of efficiencies in a procurement that would give us better spend data to help drive down the costs going forward, and accounts payable that would get rid of the paper so that we could just get things processed more. And that was kind of part of the foundation that was put forward to the board to say, if we're going to do this, we need to have, you know, the people in the right place, the tools in the to support the people, and the contracts to support the process. And so that was what the board signed off on in October. And then we went through the process. And because we have SAP as our core HR, finance, procurement, payroll system, the selection for Ariba was part of that because it was a natural fit with our core system. And so, and Jenny can take it from there in terms of the kickoff and the implementation, which was in parallel to everything that she just described in terms of bringing all the employees in over the same period of time.
Yeah, so it's been a lot of change all at once. I think it's been good to have it all happen at once, but it's interesting, like there's a lot of just people now just say, if it's a shared service thing, RPO is regional procurement office, they'll say, oh, it's RPO, but it's really, they're talking about something Ariba based. And it just it all blends together from many of the customers' perspective. So I could talk all day about sort of learnings from this implementation. I'm still organizing my thoughts on that one, but you know, having a really good change manager and trainer has been incredibly helpful. We brought someone in from the outside. She's been tremendous. So training has been really important. You know, so much of it is change management. We're uncovering these things every day that are not really about Ariba, but because of Ariba, we've discovered it. So for example, we have purchase recs in the system. And as I'm looking at them, it's $37 at Lowe's. So, you know, why wasn't that put on a P card? Or it's, you know, $99 for a referee for a baseball game. So what we're discovering is inconsistent payment processes across the universities that are funneled into our new system. But the idea, I guess they were unexpected in a way that these would be coming into the system. And then having to then get the suppliers registered. Does that make sense to call up Lowe's and say, you need to get registered in our new system? You know, your local Lowe's store. So,
or the referee.
Or, you know, you call like Jenny Doherty referee and tell her she needs to register in our new Ariba system to get her $99 check. So these are things that we're discovering every day that we need to think through thoughtfully what the right process is, what the right sort of long-term process is for these payments. I'm not going to call them procurements, but for these payments.
It's been really interesting. And we've been using the analogy of you get a new car, you know, you drive the same car for 10 years, you're very comfortable with it. And you know, it's outdated and doesn't have the latest bells and whistles because you've ridden in your, you know, your spouse has a new car and you know, yours is kind of outdated, but you're comfortable in it and you know how it works and you know what turns what on. And then you get the new car and you're just not real sure how to drive at the same time. You're changing the radio station and turning the Wi-Fi and asking Siri for directions. And right. It's a lot to learn while you're driving down the road. And so that's kind of where we are right now.
And driving down the road in a new organizational structure. You know, so you've got that compounded on top of it. I think the one thing in the technology implementation that was beneficial was we did kind of go out with we are going to adopt their best practices because the system is built on best practices. And rather than try to have it change to meet our practices, because we've got 14 sets of the same practice, and that would have been just an implosion in terms of the timeline and the ability to get consensus. And so I think that helped a lot, but to then the change management piece, it makes it harder.
Yeah, absolutely. So kind of day one, the IT director and I kind of aligned, we're not doing customizations. we're going with the best practice. And we also adopted the strategy that was basically recommended as well, that we're going to start net new with our suppliers. We're not going to pull over all this old, outdated supplier information, which I think was absolutely the right decision. It's just making it a little bit trickier now that we're live. And suppliers have to do the work of registering themselves. We can't do it for them. And so the customer's like, why isn't my supplier registered? And they're looking at us as if we're to blame. So it's, you know, it's just a lot in these early weeks getting settled into that new car.
If you had to do it all over again, would you do the two huge massive changes at once in one fell swoop, the shared services, forgetting even the strict sourcing, but the shared services and the technology upgrade, would you do them together, or would you do them sort of in sequence?
So Sharon might have a different answer than I do, but I would say absolutely I would do it the same, because in my opinion, there's only so long you can have people engulfed in change before they it's too much. They're oversaturated with change. And so this is all at once. We're all one team now. So it's like we're in it together and we're learning the new tool. We're learning the new organization. So to me, it was the right answer. It's definitely tougher, but I think it's more of a short-term challenge. That's my perspective.
I would agree. I would do it together again. Was it easy? No. Did we have a lot of bumps? Yeah. But if I had to do it again, I would do it the same way for very similar reasons, in that once you embark on change, you've got a group that's focused on it. And this is just the tool that's going to enable it, as compared to getting something in and then, you know, then bringing up again. And then it makes change harder sometimes.
I have two more questions if you have a few more minutes. One is looking backwards and one's looking forward. So the looking backwards question, Sharon, you touched a little bit on COVID and, you know, the sort of crisis of sorts that the presidents of the campuses found themselves in. How much credit should COVID get for the success you guys have had in terms of standing up this new organization, standing up this new technology, you know, as well as you have? How much of that is due to COVID? If it wasn't for COVID, would this have taken 3 years, 5 years?
I would probably say, I'll give it 9 months success to COVID. When we originally presented, the thought was it would take about 12 months to do the transition from all of the current procurement organizations into a shared service organization and stand up Ariba. And so it would have been live July of 2021. And that was the thought in probably June of 2020, you know, June, July. We was like, give us 12 months. And the response was, can you go faster? And from the presidents, they were, can you go faster? And I think it was a combination, you know, of COVID and financial sustainability combined. And, you know, we said, yes, but no, there's going to be bumps. The faster we go, the more it's going to be rocky as we go through it. I think you, your lesson is you always say that, and then everybody forgets that you say it's going to be rocky if we go, you know, everybody expects smooth sailing. Even when you tell them, when you compress your time, you're going to have bumps. And so I think there was a piece that was COVID, but we didn't put out a plan that was, you know, it'll take us 3 years to get there. We had a plan that was a 12-month plan, and they just asked us to compress it. And so we started the organization shifts, you know, 3 months after that conversation with the presidents, and 9 months later, the technology was coming in and the organization had already shifted. So this really, you know, start to finish was less than 12 months for both.
I think one thing that did help is in our new structure, the employees have the option to be virtual, and everybody was already virtual when we started this. So that whole work from home remotely was already a proven concept. It wasn't this alien concept. Like when I was at the Commonwealth, it's like, oh, people can't work from home. What are they going to do? And so that concept had been proven already because of COVID, because they were already at home. And so building this procurement shared services organization with people across the whole state working virtually, nobody really batted an eye at that. Now, we have gotten questions lately that says, oh, are these procurement people coming back to the office because the rest of the campus has to go back to the office? And I've said, no, not if they don't want to. So, you know, we committed that they would have the flexibility as long as their supervisor was okay with it, that they could work remotely. So I think that is one thing where COVID did help.
Makes sense. And then lastly, interested in what's next. You guys have accomplished so much in such a short period of time, but what does 2022 look like? What does 2023 look like?
I will let Jenny take that one.
Yeah, so there is still so much work to do. So I'll use another analogy. We've basically moved. We've moved homes and all the boxes are in. The moving truck has unloaded and pulled out of the driveway, but we're looking around at lots of boxes that need to be unpacked, and you know, pictures need to be hung on the wall, and things need to be put away and organized and put in the proper places. And so we've got all of that ahead of us and really figuring out all the tips and tricks and bells and whistles of SAP Ariba and working together as efficiently as possible. I mean, there's so much like lean operational procurement things that we can work on. We're working now on a procurement handbook. So we didn't have one. That's a giant lift. And then training everybody on those principles in the procurement handbook, creating templates that everybody uses, and this whole standardization of procurement across our new structure. We still have all of that to do.
Fine. I know you'll be busy, so I don't want to take any more of your time, so you can get back to it. But thank you both very much for your time today, and more important, for being a real inspiration for a lot of us who like seeing you know, great procurement happen, and having seen how leadership and great execution can bring about real change. It's an incredible story, and really thrilled that you shared with us today.
Thank you, David. It's been great talking about it.
Thanks for listening to Decisions That Matter. This podcast is brought to you by Procurated, the leading supplier evaluation tool for procurement professionals across the U.S. Don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you prefer to listen. See you again next time.